Turn to 1 Peter chapter 4, if you would. 1 Peter chapter 4. Still have a couple of visitors with us tonight, but our crowd has kind of moved back in the direction of our normal group, but we're certainly glad for those who are here with us that are visiting, and always especially the people who are normally here. And as was prayed earlier about being attentive in the lesson, this group is attentive, and it's encouraging to have people that listen and open their Bibles. And tonight that's what we're going to do. No PowerPoint. But I'm not. I like when you turn your Bibles and follow along. And so tonight I'm going to just have you, we're going to read from the Bible a lot. And I don't think you'll need a PowerPoint to find out where we are. But I want to read, begin with, in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verses 8 through 10. Encouragement that Peter had for the saints who were suffering near the end of the first century. He says, "Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. And be hospitable to one another without complaint. And as each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God." I'd like you to notice that he talks about that we ought to have love for one another. He also says it should be a fervent love for one another. And then he talks about a way that that love is demonstrated in hospitality. And that as we've received a gift from God, that we ought to use it in the service of others. And kind of made me remember when Jesus told the apostles, "Freely you have received, freely you shall give." So tonight what I want us to think about is hospitality. Practical lesson. Something that we can, that many of us do so well already, but it's good to think about what that the blessing it is that comes with that gift that God has given us to use. And I remember that when in our Sunday morning class, it was a test of the worthiness of those who would receive the gospel, those who would receive someone into their home to hear the word, and as long as they would listen and have them in their home, they were worthy. And that's the criteria that the disciples were to use to decide who they were to stay with, those who'd invite them in. Look over to Hebrews chapter 13, verse 1 and 2. Another exhortation of a similar nature. Again, it was ironically, it's written to Christians that were suffering. He doesn't tell us to be hospitable only when times are good, things are going well for us, but in Hebrews, people were struggling with their faith, and he says, here's one way you demonstrate your love. Verse 1, let the love of the brethren continue. And then he says in verse 2, do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by this some have entertained angels without knowing it. There's that idea of love again. You say, what does it mean? You know, the disciples said, or the lawyer said to Jesus, what does it mean to love one another? And Jesus could have said, well, you need to show hospitality to people. That would be a response he could have given him. Show hospitality, even to strangers. Strangers, is he talking about non-Christians here or people in the world? I don't know, but, you know, a Christian that I've never met before is sort of like a stranger until I meet him and have him into my home to get to know him. But there's probably an allusion here to the story of Abraham. Most of us would probably see that story in that reference back in Genesis, I think chapter 18 or 19, whenever the men came to Abraham's tent and he welcomed them in and prepared a meal for them, and it turned out they were angels. And they told him about the judgment of God against Sodom. But I don't want to talk about that story tonight. I do want to look at a story that illustrates hospitality that I really like. And I want us to go back to 2 Kings for that story. 2 Kings chapter 4. And that's really where we're going to spend the rest of our time. And just think about hospitality and the blessing that it is, not only to others, but to yourself. And this story revolves around Elisha, who is God's prophet, and he was unwelcome in the time that he prophesied, just like Elijah was, because there was so much idolatry, and God's prophets didn't endorse that. And Elisha spoke against that. And God had to do some work to find people to care for him, because who would care for a prophet in a nation that didn't really care for God? And so God found those hearts, though, good hearts among his people, who were still committed to him. And this is a story about a woman in the land of Shunem. And I want us just to read through this story tonight. So if you could plan to stay with me just a little in these next couple of chapters, and we'll learn a little bit about this woman who illustrates for us the blessing of hospitality. Let's start in verse 8 here. Now there came a day when Elisha passed over to Shunem, where there was a prominent woman, and she persuaded him to eat food. And so it was, as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat food. I want you to notice the simple point, first of all, that she persuaded him. This is a woman who wanted a man with the Word of God in her home. She was persistent. We were talking about Lydia the other night, Wednesday night class, and we were sort of talking about whether she was rich or poor, and we were looking at the possibilities of that. But I'll tell you what, this woman was prominent, no doubt about that. But you know what's the point that was important, whether you're talking about Lydia or this woman, is that what she really valued. She didn't value what she had. She valued the Lord and his having this man in her home, and she convinced him. I like that. I mean, she persuaded him that to eat food with her. And so as often as he passed by, he turned in there, she was able to convince him that he was welcome. You can't be invited to somebody's house and then later think, I don't know if they really liked that I was there. I don't know how welcome I really was. But this lady seemed to persuade this man, I want you to be in my home. And he came. And every time he came by there, evidently he came into her home. That's a good example for us, a good model for us of hospitality. Being able to be persuasive, persuade others that you want them to come into your home, those of God's people. But more than that, look in verse 9 through 11. She said to her husband, "Behold, now I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Please let us make a little walled upper chamber and let us set a bed for him there, and a table and a chair and a lampstand. And it shall be, when he comes to us, that he can turn in there." And one day he came there and turned into the upper chamber and rested. She not only persuaded the man that he was welcome, but she also persuaded her family. She persuaded her husband in this particular case that, you know, we need to make accommodations for this person. We need to prepare and make accommodations for this man. It's important to persuade our family about hospitality. Important for parents to persuade their children that this is what, you know, these are the gifts God's given us, and we need to use them to bless others. We need to make our home a place that's hospitable. Or maybe a spouse needs to, in a kind way, persuade the other spouse of that. And so she uses her means to be a blessing to other people. That seems like it just about reflects exactly what we read in 1 Peter chapter 4 earlier when he tells us in that context, "Be hospitable to one another without complaint, and as each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God." She had a gift, and she knew that was a blessing that she needed to use as a service to other people, because it was a grace of God toward her, and so she was showing that same mercy and favor toward other people. Well, the story goes on. This man comes and he visits her, and it's happened continually over and over again. He's profited from her sacrifice and hospitality. So then, when he's there that day, verse 12, he's there. And let's read verse 12 through 17. He says to his servant, whose name was Gehazi, "Call the Shunammite. And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, so Elisha is speaking to his servant with the Shunammite there. Say now to her, behold, you have been careful for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Would you be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the army? And she said, I live among my own people. And so he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered and said, truly she has no son, and her husband is old. And he said, call her. And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And he said, at this season next year, you will embrace a son. And she said, no, my lord, O man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. And the woman conceived and bore a son at the season the next year, as Elisha had said to her. This woman was obviously barren. I don't know how old she was. It says her husband was old, but I would suspect she's at least to some, you know, some age to where she is very aware that she is not going to have any children, at least as far as she's able to conceive. And you can tell in this that she didn't, you know, she wasn't hospitable for what she could get out of it. You know, what can we do for you? Can we mention you to the king? Can we mention you to the guard? She says, I don't want anything. You know, I live among my own people. I'm fine, just the way I am. But you can imagine, and most of you who are Bible students know that a woman who was barren in those days, that was a shameful thing. She was disgraced. That was the principal role of a woman, and they accepted that with honor. And this woman would have been to some degree scorned by her community, even though she's prominent. But he's going to take away her shame and give her the gift that she didn't think was possible. And she says, you know, don't lie to me. This is beyond what I could ever imagine. Please don't tell me you'll give me something that you can't give. And he says, it's going to happen this next season, and so it does. And I want you to notice the passage. The lesson that I gained from this, as I think about this lesson, is the blessings that you get is far beyond anything that you'll ever give. The blessings that you receive in return for the hospitality that you extend goes far beyond any that you could ever imagine. And Jesus, in Mark chapter 10, when he was teaching his disciples about what it would mean to have to sacrifice everything for the kingdom of heaven, he had a rich young ruler, and the rich young ruler was a fairly good man, but he treasured and cherished his money more than he did the Lord. And after Jesus had finished talking to him, the disciples were just in awe. They were saying, well, if this guy can't be saved, who can be saved? And Jesus says, in is teaching them down in verse 27, he says, with people it's impossible, but with God all things are possible. And Peter says, listen, we've left everything. You know, this guy won't leave his money, but we've left everything to follow you. And I like what Jesus says here. He says in verse 29, truly I say to you, there's no one who's left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or farms for my sake and for the gospel's sake, but that he will receive 100 times as much now in the present age, houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and farms, along with persecutions in the age to come, eternal life. So Jesus rejects the rich young ruler, but notice what he values. He values the one who will sacrifice everything. And he says that, you know, the blessings that you will receive far outweigh the things that you will give up. And that's hospitality. That's part of hospitality, sacrificing what you have for others. And looking for the blessing that will come in response to that. It's far greater than what you give up. And then look back to this story again in 2 Kings chapter 4. Well, she receives a son. The promise was true. The son comes, the child, in verse 18. And you expect the story to keep moving upwards, but it takes a quick turn in a negative direction. When the child was grown, the day came that he went out to his father to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. And he said to his servant, carry him to his mother. And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon, and he died. I don't know what grown up means here. He still was able to sit on his mother's lap, but I suspect a mother will hold his son no matter how big he is if he's dying. But he's old enough to work out in the fields with his father. He's got some age, some degree of maturity, but he has some type of issue that comes up. Brain aneurysm, I don't know what it was, but it was serious. And the boy dies. And that seems like almost the very opposite of what you'd expect in this story. I mean, it just doesn't seem to fit. Things are moving in a positive direction. This lady's done so much. She's been blessed beyond her means. And then all of a sudden she loses the blessing that she's received. But you know, blessings in this life are temporal. And that includes not merely our physical blessings, but lives and relationships that we have. Why we ought to treasure the relationships we have every day, because we are not promised and guaranteed that they're going to be around. Time and chance happens to all. And God doesn't make us immune to the tragedies and calamities of this life. And one of the things in Ecclesiastes, he says, you can't be so righteous that you can escape the unfairness of this world. You just can't do it. You can try to be righteous, you ought to be righteous, but you can't be righteous enough that God's going to just exempt you from the difficulties that come in this life. And she loses the greatest gift that God had given her, at least in this world, is this son that she had never had. Well, verse 22, look at her response. It says, or verse 20, when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap till noon, and he died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, and shut the door behind him, and went out. And she called to her husband, and said, please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God and return. And he said, why will you go to him today? It is neither the new moon nor the Sabbath. And she said, it will be well. I think she shared a very intimate relationship with God. Now, her relationship wasn't ritual. Wasn't just a Sunday, a Sabbath day. That's when you could go and pray or talk to the priest or whatever. It was more of an intimate relationship where, you know, God had a place in her home. God had a place in her heart. And she believed that she had a special place in God's heart. And she could go to him and call on him at any time, and he would hear her. And she was confident of that. So she says, well, we're going now. And she you know, calls, it says she saddled the donkey in verse 24 and said to her servant, drive and go forward and do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you. And so you can almost visualize this chariot plowing across the plains, and you wouldn't want to get in front of it. This lady is on a mission, and she's going to see the man of God. And she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. And when the man of God saw her at a distance, he said to Gehazi, his servant, behold, there's the Shunammite. Please run now and meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child? I like that this man, he immediately responds. He sees her in the distance. And he says, hey, look, there she is. Go see how she's doing. And sends the servant to greet her. And then she says, well, it's okay, it's well, which is a strange reply. But then when she came to the man of God on the hill, she caught hold of his feet. And Gehazi came near to try to push her away, but the man of God said, leave her alone, for her soul is troubled within her, and the Lord has hidden it from me, and he hasn't told me. And she said, did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? And he said to Gehazi, gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. And if you meet any man, do not salute him. And if anyone salutes you, don't answer him. And lay my staff on the lad's face. And so he says, you know, right away, he says, you take off and you hit the road running. And don't stop till you get to this lady's house. And you fix this problem. You go and take care of whatever she needs. You feel love coming out of this man as he sees this woman. But she's not satisfied with that. She's not happy with just the servant going. She said in verse 30, the lad said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. And he said, she said, you're going too. I want you to go with me. And so he arose and followed her. And then Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was no sound or response. And so he returned to meet him and told him, the lad has not awakened. We're going to read down through verse 27, real quick, or 37, if you don't mind. And when Elisha came into the house, behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. And so he entered and shut the door behind him and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and laid on the child and put his mouth on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself on him. And the flesh of the child became warm. And he returned and walked in the house once back and forth and went up and stretched himself on him. And the lad sneezed seven times. And the lad opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and he said, call the Shunammite. And he called her, and when she came into him, he said, take up your son. And she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground, and she took up her son and went out. So this man goes the extra mile. He himself accompanies her and goes to the place where this man, little boy, or this young man had died. And he raises him from the dead. You know, in the sequence of people that's been raised from the dead, where this one falls? He's number two, if I'm not mistaken. There's one more, at least, that I found before this that had already been raised from the dead, and that was in the time of Elijah. And we have time. Let's look back just real quick, just three verses in 1 Kings chapter 17. And I'll tell you what I think is happening. God is doing the same thing with Elisha in the miracles that he worked, as he did with Elijah in the miracles that Elijah worked. You can see the parallels, because in this particular time, people believed in false gods, dead gods, idols, lived in the days of Ahab. This is Jehoram's days, and they worshiped gods that had no power. And what God was trying to teach him was that he was a God that was not impotent, but a God who had real power. And so here in this particular story, Elijah is with a widow who is caring for him. And if you look down to verse 21, it says, here's her son had died. Why don't we read verse 19. He said to her, give me your son. And he took him from her bosom and carried him up to the upper room where he was living and laid him on his own bed. And he called to the Lord and said, oh, Lord my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? Isn't that interesting, the parallel between the two stories? And he stretched himself upon the child three times, called to the Lord, and he prays and says, O Lord my God, I pray to you, let this child's life return to him. The Lord heard the voice of Elijah, the life of the child returned to him, and he revived. And he took the child, brought him down from the upper room into the house, gave him to his mother, and Elijah said, see, your son is alive. And she said to Elijah, now I know that you're a man of God, and the word of the Lord in your mouth is true. Very similar, the stories. And even if you look in the New Testament, you'll find a story very similar to that when Jesus healed the widow's son, or at least the Jairus' daughter, who had died, to show that he too was along the same lines as these prophets, ones who had the power to raise the dead. And so, you know, I just want you to notice again, upon whom are God's greatest gifts being given? To those who believe in him, to those who heed the word of his prophet. This widow in the story of Elijah receives her son back from the dead. This woman, this Shunammite woman with being helped by Elisha, receives her son back from the dead. These are women who believed in the Lord and in the word of the prophet. And the Lord valued them and showed that. You know, this lesson is maybe more for women than men, but certainly there's application to the men too. But it seems like, honestly, when it comes to hospitality, it's the women who do a lot of the arranging and sacrificing and planning and using their house and their facilities. And it's a great lesson to see another one of the women who modeled that for us in the Bible. In verse 38, something else that happens. She receives her son back. Things have kind of taken a swing back upward, haven't they? She's gained her son. She's She has her blessing back again, but then there's another issue. There's a famine, and Palestine is not unusual for famines to take place in that land, and particularly in this time ones that God would send deliberately. When Elisha returned to Gilgal, there was a famine in the land. As the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, he said to his servant, "Put a large pot on the boil, stew for the sons of the prophets." And he goes on, and there's a couple other issues that take place, but there's a famine. And if you turn over now, look over to chapter 8. This is the last part of this. Look over to 2 Kings chapter 8. There's a lot of difficulty during that time. Famine's around. People are dying. Jerusalem's gets attacked by other marauding bands of the Arameans. All these are consequences of people who don't love the Lord and don't care for Him and are worshiping idols. And so God is punishing them, but even those who are righteous suffer during the midst of that judgment. And here's this Shunammite, and look in chapter 8 and verse 1. "Now Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life. And he said, 'Arise and go with your household and sojourn wherever you can sojourn. For the Lord has called for a famine, and it will even come on the land for 7 years.' And so the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God. And she went out with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines for 7 years." This woman shows a lot of trust, doesn't she? She's not just hospitable, but she obeys the word of the prophet. She takes her whole family. She leaves everything that she has, her home, her land. And she was a prominent woman. She would have had a good bit of means there. I don't know. You would think maybe she could have survived it. Maybe she could have said, "Well, I can survive this. I can weather this storm. I've got the means that other people don't have. I can stay here." But she follows the word of the Lord, and she goes away for 7 years into the land of the Philistines. And then verse 3 of this chapter, at the end of 7 years, the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went out to appeal to the king for her house and for her field. She has nothing. She comes back, she's broke. She has nothing to her name. Doesn't have a house, doesn't have fields. She's lost everything. And I don't know if the king took the property or if he sells it to others while she's gone or leases it. Jehoram is the king at this time. But she's in there and she's asking him. She comes to his presence to see if she can get her property and her house back. In verse 4, look what's happening. "Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, and saying, 'Please relate to me all the great things that Elisha has done.'" I wonder why he wanted to know that. I wonder if it didn't have something to do with the fact that he knew that probably the reason that they were having a famine was because they were disobedient to the Lord. They wanted to know what Elisha had to do with it. And they knew that was the man that he needed to talk to if he wanted to repent. But he's talking to Elisha. He wants to talk to Elisha. In verse 5, it says, "As he was relating to the king how he," that is Elisha, "had restored to life the one who was dead, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and for her field." What a coincidence. What a coincidence. At the same time the servant of Elisha is talking to the king, the woman comes in and appeals to him to get her property back. And it says in the last part of chapter 5, "And Gehazi said, 'My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son, whom Elisha restored to life.' And when the king asked the woman, she related it to him. And so the king appointed for her a certain officer and said, 'Restore all that was hers, and all the produce of the field from the day that she left the land, even until now.'" And so she gets it all back, everything. Isn't that amazing? That here's a woman who lost everything, but she gains it all back. It was as though she never had lost her blessings. You know, when we give up what we have to do God's will and obey His prophet, then we will be blessed. In Luke chapter 6, as Jesus taught the Sermon on the Mount, He said in Luke chapter 6, verse 38, "Give, and it will be given to you. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return." Here's a woman who poured out, and she gave, and she filled up the basket of Elisha, and God filled up her basket in return, all to her again. I mean, it's kind of like the story of a person's life. I mean, life is full of ups and downs. I mean, you have, God blesses us, and then He permits things to be taken away. And He blesses us, and He permits things to be taken away. And He blesses us. And we have to live, and she's living a life that everybody else had to live. But hospitality is how this whole thing started. She was a hospitable woman. And that's something that we all can do. And I'll read one other passage in Mark chapter 9, verse 41. Because sometimes you might think, well, she was prominent. You know, she was rich. She had lots of money. She had lots of resources. So, you know, she can do that. But I don't have a lot. And I like what Jesus said. Again, His apostles are always impressed with those who had much. But Jesus said to these apostles in verse 41, "For whoever gives you a cup of cold water, a cup of water to drink, because of your name as followers of Christ, truly I say, he will not lose his reward." A cup of water. The apostles admired those with much. And Jesus admired those who are hospitable. He values different things than we value. I don't think we ever want to discourage someone from being hospitable. Someone, maybe they don't, you know, sometimes we can feel inadequate. My house isn't as nice, or I don't have as much. I can only serve Twinkies for dessert. You know, I can't make this fancy dessert. That's okay. Twinkies will be just fine. But we need to do what we can. This lady could just offer a cup of cold water. And that's all that, and God knew that. And then I want to close with a story from Mark 14. One other illustration of this type of spirit that we see illustrated in these other verses. This is the last week of Jesus' life. And it's about 2 days before the Passover. And Mark tells a story, and then he interrupts himself and does a flashback, and then he comes back to his story. So we're going to read verses 1 through 9. And I want you to notice the contrast between two people in the story. "Now the Passover and unleavened bread were 2 days away, and the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to seize him by stealth and kill him. For they were saying, not during the festival, otherwise there might be a riot of the people. And while he was in Bethany at the home of Simon the leper, and reclining at table, there came a woman with an alabaster vial of very costly perfume, a pure nard, and she broke the vial, and she poured it over his head. But there were some were there indignantly remarking to one another, why has this perfume been wasted? For this perfume might have been sold for over 300 denarii, and the money given to the poor. And they were scolding her. And Jesus said, let her alone. Why do you bother her? She has done a good deed to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you wish, you can do good for them, but you don't always have me. And she's done what she could, and she's anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will be spoken in memory of her. And Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went off to the chief priest in order to betray him to them. And they were glad when they heard this and promised to give him money. And he began seeking how to betray him at an opportune time." So he says, 2 days before the Passover, the Jews are conspiring. They're looking for somebody to give him a way in, looking for somebody to give him an angle to be able to arrest Jesus. And guess who raises his hand and says, I'll help? Judas. And he says, I'll help you. I'll take you to him. He says, but for how much? 30 pieces of silver. What kind of man do you have here? You have a man who is self-centered. You have a man who is greedy. You have a man who is thinking about himself. And that problem that he had with greed led him to betray our Lord. But there's another person in the story too, isn't there? That was 2 days before the feast. But 4 days before that, was what happened when Jesus was in Bethany, when this woman came. You can read that in John chapter 12. But he kind of, Mark kind of flashes back to a few days earlier when Jesus was at the house of Martha and Mary and Lazarus, and she poured this oil over his head, and all the disciples were there, and they were furious, indignant. She's wasting this stuff. And he says, "Leave her alone. I mean, look what she's doing. She's doing this for me. For her, this woman, there's no, she didn't calculate the value of that perfume. And what she did was she valued him. And the value of the perfume was nothing because it was something she could do for him. That she illustrates the selfless woman, the woman who is focused on others and not on herself, the one who wants to bless the Lord instead of thinking about herself. And what a contrast between her and Judas, and even a contrast between her and the other apostles, at least at that moment. But Jesus valued her and said that she would always be remembered. When the gospel was preached, that woman who did that act of selfless love would always be remembered. It wasn't hospitality per se, but it's the spirit of hospitality. It's the same spirit as she gave up what was hers to bless another. How will you be remembered? How do you want to be remembered? Hospitality was an act of love. God certainly demonstrated hospitality to us in the greatest way. He came down and sent his own son to die so that he could invite us to be with him. He's going to share his rooms with us. He's going to share his place with us. Give us a place in heaven to be with him. What a generous God we have. What a God who has sacrificed everything in order to give us a place to be with him. Can we do that too? We need to be of that same spirit, that same nature. That's the simple answer for why in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, when there was famines and problems in Palestine in the early church, they sold everything they had, sold their farms, sold property, and shared with them. Why do they do that? Why do they do that? Because somebody had just done that for them. Somebody had just given up everything in order to make it possible for them to have life. And that's what motivates us. That's the motivating factor for hospitality, is what God has done for us. We need to learn to do for others. Did you do that tonight? Would you respond to the Lord's generous gift to you of his love? Respond by giving back your life to him, making your life a sacrifice, put on the altar and sacrifice yourself and your ideas and your thinking and your own ways in order to walk in his ways and to be a blessing to others. This evening will be an opportunity to begin that walk by believing in him and being baptized, repenting of your sins as we stand and sing our song.